Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Thank you. My name is Len Gill, and I'm the Chairman of Infigen Energy. Before we get started, can I just remind you all to turn off your mobile phones? We're here to talk about energy and not telecoms. As both Chairman and a fellow security holder, it is my pleasure to welcome you to our 2018 Annual General Meeting. I acknowledge the Gadigal people, the traditional custodians of this land, and I also pay respect to their elders, both past and present, of the Eora Nation, and extend that respect to other Aboriginal people present. Our company secretary advises that a quorum of security holders is present, and I now declare the Infigen Energy Annual General Meeting open. All security holders have been sent the notice of meeting, so we will take that as read. There were copies outside in the lobby, but please let our staff know if you need another copy. The proxy votes received for today's resolutions have been inspected by our security agency, and all validly lodged proxies have been accepted. The numbers of proxy votes for each resolution will be displayed on the screen as we deal with each resolution. As Chairman, I will cast all undirected proxies that I hold in favor of the relevant resolutions. Before we start the formal business of the meeting, I would like to introduce the board of directors. Ross Rolfe is our Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Ross has been in that role since late 2016, but he's been a non-executive director since 2011. Sylvia Wiggins is our Executive Director of Finance and Commercial, having been appointed in May 2017. Sylvia was also previously a non-executive director, appointed in April 2016. Emma Stein joined the board as an independent non-executive director in September 2017, and Emma is chairperson of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee and a member of the Nom and Rem Committee. Mark Chellew joined the board as an independent non-executive director in September 2017, and Mark is chairman of the Nomination Remuneration Committee and a member of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. One of our fellow board members gives his apologies, not able to be present with us today. Phil has not been able to fly to Australia at this time, Philip Green, and has offered his apology for the meeting. Phil is the nominee director of the Children's Investment Master Fund, which holds approximately 33% of our securities. Phil has been a non-executive director since November 2010 and is a member of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. As indicated in the notice of meeting, Phil retires by rotation at this AGM and offers himself for re-election. I joined the board as an independent director in June 2017 and was elected chairman in December that year upon the retirement of Mike Hutchinson. Further information regarding the experience and qualifications of each director is included in the annual report. We are joined today by Infigen's Company Secretary, David Richardson, and by members of Infigen's senior management team. The company's external auditor, PricewaterhouseCoopers, is present today, represented by Mark Upcroft and Craig Thomason, and I thank both gentlemen for their attendance today. Infigen's 2018 annual report details the company's financial and operating performance during the year. Copies of the report are available at this meeting. Over the last 2 years, Infigen Energy has been transitioning its business model to adapt to changes in the Australian electricity market. I am pleased to report on the progress we've made during FY18 and outline the challenges and opportunities ahead. I will be followed by our MD, Ross Rolfe, who will take you through these in more detail. Safety is our number one priority, both the safety of our people and the communities in which we operate. We are relentless in the pursuit of continuous improvement to our culture and our safety systems as we seek to achieve zero harm. During the past 12 months, we've combined engineering solutions and improved work practices to further reduce or eliminate safety risks from our operating assets. We've continued to review any incidents or accidents to determine how they can be avoided in the future, and we recorded one lost time injury in FY18. Pleasingly, Lake Bonnie and Alinta wind farms marked more than 10 years without any lost time injuries. But we are not complacent. Maintaining our assets necessarily involves technicians working with high voltages and at height, creating potential safety risks which must be carefully managed. We commend the diligence and the vigilance with which Infident staff and our contractor teams have maintained their focus and embedded safety as part of their mindset, attitudes, and daily work practices. We remain focused on managing the risks during construction at the Badangara Wind Farm, which is in its final stages, and the construction of our South Australian battery project, which is in its early stages. We continue to strive for our goal of zero harm every day. Our performance. Our FY18 results were characterized by strong financial performance and significant progress in the transitioning of Infigen Energy to being an active participant in the energy market. Highlights include: we increased our underlying EBITDA by 7% to $149.1 million in a period where electricity prices saw some moderation from the highs of FY17. Our production increased to 1549 gigawatt-hours of renewable energy, up 4% from FY17. We successfully executed our multi-channel route-to-market strategy. This has delivered better than target generation sales to C&I customers, and our electricity revenue is now better balanced in tenor across the portfolio. We received strong pricing in the face of flat or declining prices as a result of this contracting strategy. In New South Wales, Infigen's electricity price increased 7% during a period of flat New South Wales wholesale prices, and in South Australia we maintained a flat pricing even though the market saw a wholesale price decline. We delivered a capital structure to support our business strategy. This creates flexibility to allow Infigen to manage all assets as one portfolio and provides liquidity facilities to support the execution of the business strategy. It is especially pleasing to have secured this refinancing package at this time, given uncertainties regarding the outlook for debt and equity markets and, of course, ongoing uncertainty in the Australian energy market policy settings. I'd like to acknowledge the efforts of Ross and particularly Sylvia Wiggins and her finance team in this regard. We also successfully advanced our strategy for firming through investment in a battery energy storage system in South Australia, also known as BESS. This allows us to contract further customers in South Australia while managing the risks associated with our intermittent production. Construction of the 25 megawatt, 52 megawatt hour BESS is already underway. Access to energy storage creates the ability to supply ancillary services also, ensuring increased security and quality of supply and fast response services as demand require. Infigen is playing its role in ensuring that the system remains secure and reliable while transitioning to a generation mix comprising dispatchable and intermittent generation with a lower carbon emissions footprint. The energy policy debate. It is a great frustration to the market and broader population that national energy policy remains unresolved. Personally, as a participant in the energy industry of nearly 40 years, it is disappointing to see energy policy simplified by some to calls of "let's use a big stick" and the occasional outcry from others of "we want a new coal plant." It's also amazing to see so many expert reports commissioned and key recommendations disregarded. The following is a list of few of the key factors at work in the Australian energy market. Energy from renewable energy generation is now lower cost than that produced by black coal and gas sources. Our legacy coal generation fleet is ageing and becoming less reliable, and the demand profile to be served by dispatchable plant is becoming peakier and more variable due to the increasing installation of renewable energy sources in front of and behind the meter. And of course, all this needs to be in the context of Australia's commitments and the public's desire to play its role in addressing global CO2 emission issues. The energy challenges we currently face will not be solved by 1970s solutions. In short, the industry is transitioning to a mix of lower cost and lower emission sources of intermittent generation, which must be matched with a progressively increasing variety of sources of flexible dispatchable generation and storage. There is little doubt that investor confidence is being adversely affected by the ongoing uncertainty in energy policy. A focus for all governments should be to re-establish policy settings which rebuild investor confidence to ensure the industry is willing to make the necessary investments. While electricity market continues to be volatile and national policy remains unresolved, the fundamental direction remains clear, although the pace of change is uncertain. It is against this backdrop that the board continues to make decisions about investment and our strategic future. Ross Rolfe will cover these issues and how they impact our business in more detail in his address. Our business strategy. Infigen continues to increase and deepen its participation in the energy market. With increased revenue stability and multiple channels to market for sales of electricity and LGCs, Infigen has positioned itself to benefit from growth and development opportunities. Our strategy focuses on growth through being able to contract our capacity for sales, a significant widening of our marketing channels to target C&I customers rather than the traditional long-term power purchase agreements, and a more active management of our portfolio and its risk profile. Specifically, we have identified three interrelated growth opportunities: firming capacity, growth in generation, and growth in our customer service capability. Underpinning our strategic pathway is increasing our ability to manage the risks associated with contracting firm supply, growing additional generation, and enhancing our ability to better service customers through improved retailing capability. New technology is starting to play a role ensuring that intermittent renewable energy generation can be accommodated effectively as part of the transmission and distribution grid. Batteries, open cycle gas turbines, and pump storage are expected to make an increasing contribution to grid stability and, over time, in dispatch. Infigen is and will continue to be part of that evolution. In particular, our investment in firming technology with our grid-scale battery in South Australia increases our capacity to pursue additional C&I sales, while protecting our contract and pricing position during times of high energy prices and reduced generation. Firming also enables Infigen to respond to changing market dynamics, which we believe is consistent with the likely objectives of future energy policy. Our business strategy is supported by detailed work and a long-term but flexible planning framework to which we are all committed. Increasing our generation portfolio, either owned or capital light, is a key tenet of future growth. I'm pleased to report that construction is well advanced at Badangra Wind Farm, which remains on budget and is expected to be operationally complete in the first half of 2019. And Badangra is expected to increase our annual production across our portfolio by 24% per annum when it becomes fully operational. In addition, we continue to progress our Cherry Tree Wind Farm in Victoria, potentially as a capital light investment, and our Flyers Creek project in New South Wales. We will continue to grow our customer service capability, our systems and our people, as we continue to build our sales to C&I customers. Our new corporate finance facility provides flexibility to allow Infigen to manage all assets as one portfolio. In addition, it provides liquidity facilities to support the continued successful execution of our business strategy, and it allows free cash flow from operations after debt service, to be used to support Infigen's future growth and any future capital management. Market conditions remain favourable, enabling the company to continue to produce significant free cash flows. The board is mindful of the needs to fund future capital and the benefits of further strengthening of our balance sheet. The board has approved a distribution policy. It does not propose to introduce payment of a dividend at this current time, but we envisage further review at full year results. An update on Brookfield. We were pleased to welcome the Brookfield Group onto our register during FY18. Since that time, Infigen has held discussions with the Brookfield Group about Brookfield's interest in being a strategic investor and a capital partner for Infigen. These discussions are continuing, and any agreement would need to be in the interests of all security holders. Remuneration. The board undertook a review of our remuneration structure this year. The key changes are rebalancing of the remuneration mix to increase the potential short-term incentive available for achieving transformational near-term goals. And this means for FY19 and beyond, the split between STI and LTI will be 65-35. It was 50-50 previously. The total quantum of at-risk remuneration is unchanged. There is a reduction in the deferred STI component from 50% to 20% of STI awarded, and this is to be paid in cash. The operational performance condition of the FY19 LTI has been reviewed and the criteria broadened. Details are disclosed in the notice of meeting and the supplementary ASX release. The board believes that these changes result in our remuneration framework remaining market competitive and better aligned with the delivery of our business strategy. Board composition. The board has undertaken a renewal process over the last 18 months. We welcomed two new directors, Mark Chalew and Emma Stein, around 12 months ago. We are well advanced in the recruitment of an additional director, and this will provide the board with a majority of independent directors. Community. Fostering strong relationships with our host communities, attracting and engaging talented people, and understanding of the needs and concerns of our communities form an intrinsic part of how Infigen conducts its business. We continue to set ourselves sustainability targets to achieve commitments made to our communities, to the environment, and to improve our diversity. We believe these are key to create and protect security holder value. We are committed to community engagement and support in the regions around our operating and development assets, and we seek to maintain strong ties in these communities and to share the economic benefits that our projects generate. As an example of our commitment, following commencement of the Badangara project, we delivered $50,000 of community grants into the Wellington area. We will deliver that amount of money for at least the next 20 years. We have previously advised of a fire which occurred in the vicinity of the Capital and Woodlawn wind farms on 17th of January 2017. As a result of the fire, Infigen was served with legal proceedings. We can now report that these legal proceedings have been successfully resolved through settlement agreements with respective parties. A class action settlement remains subject to court approval, with the court scheduled to consider the terms of that settlement on 7th December. If approved, those proceedings will be concluded. The terms of the agreed settlements are confidential. However, the settled amounts will not have a material financial impact on Infigen, as the company maintains appropriate insurance sufficient to cover the terms of the settlement. More detail on our environmental, social and governance performance can be found in our annual report and in our environmental and social governance report published on our website each calendar year. Outlook. During FY18, Infigen continued to make substantial progress in execution of our business strategy. Our delivery of a revised capital structure and a commitment to physical firming has laid the groundwork for continued execution of our strategy in FY19. The solid execution of the multi-channel route to market strategy in FY19 has positioned Infigen to achieve increased revenue stability in FY19 and beyond, and we continue to secure further C&I customer sales. Badangara wind farm will reach operational completion in the first half of FY19, and our battery storage capability is expected to commence first operations in the second half of FY19. As Infigen increases its capacity, both on balance sheet or through its capital-light funding model, and expands access to firming options, it will be able to increase its C&I customer base. We expect in these circumstances to be able to contract additional forward sales on favourable terms. having regard to tenor and price, and which will contribute to more stable revenue outcomes in the future. Execution of our business strategies delivered significant free cash flow to reduce debt and fund growth in FY18 and continues to do so. It has also substantially improved the capability of the business to capture value from ongoing changes in the energy market, as well as to strengthen its resilience to the associated risks to the benefit of all security holders. It's been a busy year for the Invigen team, with much achieved. I'd like to acknowledge the commitment and continued energetic focus of Ross Rolfe and his team in addressing Invigen's continuing challenges and opportunities. I'd like to thank all Invigen staff for their hard work and contributions to our business during the year. I'd like to thank my fellow directors for their contribution and support during the year. And finally, I'd like to thank you, our security holders, for your continued support, and in particular during this period when government energy policy has yet to appropriately address the challenges ahead. I now invite Invigen's Managing Director, Ross Rolfe, to address the meeting.
Thank you so much, Len. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, good morning to Miles George. It's good to see you here, Miles. Miles is my predecessor, for those of you who don't know, as the MD of Infogen. Since I spoke to you 12 months ago, much has occurred within our company and in the energy market more broadly. FY18 has been a year in which Infogen has continued to execute the business strategy that we outlined to the market at our AGM 2 years ago and have regularly updated the market since. Today, I propose to provide you with a further report on progress we've made in that regard. I'll focus in particular on broader developments in the market and the national policy environment, which will likely influence market conditions and participant behaviour going forward. I also intend to discuss the implications of these developments on our own strategy and the relative priorities within it. I will conclude by discussing our approach to capital management in the light of these conditions. To begin, I feel it's important to provide some context for the discussion for newer security holders who may be here today. Our current business strategy was developed over recent years in the light of the impact we anticipated from forces that we saw emerging across both the global and the domestic energy markets. The progressive retirement of coal-fired generation from active service and the limited substitution function due to pricing of gas in the domestic market, combined with the relentless decline in the cost of renewables, meant that renewables should logically and inevitably play an increasingly significant role in the energy supply industry going forward. By FY17, the market dynamics for renewables, following the apparent resolution of the RET in FY16, had shifted to a point where the demand for PPAs had substantially reduced. Accordingly, the market price for PPAs had declined to a point where contracting new or recontracting existing plant would be value decretive from our company's perspective. In addition, while the market conditions were yielding attractive spot prices for both energy and LGCs, we did not see these combined prices as sustainable over time as the market responded to signals for new investment. The expiry of the Foundation PPA contracts for Infogen's Lake Bonnie 1 wind farm in South Australia in 2015 therefore presented both a short-term opportunity as well as a potential long-term challenge to Infogen. High prices could be obtained in the short-term spot market for uncontracted production, but recontracting the plant output under long-term fixed-price run-of-plant PPAs would erode security holder value. This led us to explore the wider opportunities and challenges in the evolving market and to consider how to reposition the company under new and changing conditions. These conditions included the emergence of commercial and industrial scale customer segment from a reliance on short-term contracts from larger retailers and with an appetite to enter longer-term supply agreements directly with generators, and with a bias in favour of competitively priced renewables. Key strengths we identified for Infogen in the emerging market included: we still had significant residual service life across our fleet of assets. Our fleet was capable of being operationally managed as a portfolio through our operational control centre. We had an established energy markets capability. We held appropriate licences to operate a retail business, and we had a legacy development pipeline that was capable of being commercialised to produce additional capacity, if required, to support customer demand. Key challenges we identified were we did not own any physical firming plant, limiting our capacity to contract to provide firm supplies of energy. We had limited resources to engage directly with the customer segment. In our assessment, the value of the LGCs we produced was likely to fall relative to the value of energy as the RET target was progressively met, dependent upon the future shape of government policy. We had a legacy debt facility that commercially limited our ability to operate the stable of assets as a portfolio, and our cost of funds reduced our competitiveness in terms of investing in new capacity. Our business plan has been shaped to enable us to build on our strengths as well as address the challenges outlined above. Accordingly, first, we've prioritised the list of development projects according to their potential to produce energy rather than LGCs in the most prospective of the Australian sub-regional energy markets. Second, we've progressed the construction of our Budangaroo project, which is scheduled for operational completion by the end of the first half of FY19. This will increase our energy production by 24% across a full year of operations. It will provide us with secure revenues for 60% of the production under long-term PPA with Energy Australia and supply the balance either to new C&I customers or sell into the spot market. Turbines have progressively been completed and commissioned since August, and 22 of the 33 turbines are now operational. They're undergoing final commissioning and reliability testing. By the end of November, we expect that 30 turbines will be operating. The remaining 3 turbines await some blade repairs to be completed. These are expected to be commissioned in late December. This slippage in the construction timetable is not expected, however, to adversely affect the project's projected contribution to our FY19 revenues. Third, we've explored a range of funding models designed to enable us to take advantage of the availability of lower cost capital. As a result, in Victoria, we've contracted 30 megawatts of supply under a 5-year PPA from the Kiato Wind Farm and are advancing the Cherry Tree Wind Farm project under a capital light model in that state. The Cherry Tree project timetable has been impacted by the introduction of a requirement for several additional grid studies by the network owner. These requirements are designed to ensure that the strength of the network is maintained once the new build is connected to the grid. The introduction of additional grid studies and the potential implications for new projects explain significant delays being encountered by project proponents in many parts of the network. Cherry Tree is unfortunately no exception to this rule. A final decision to proceed or not with the Cherry Tree project will be made once we're in a position to examine the final business case in the light of the market outlook. Fourth, we've enhanced our internal capability in energy markets and energy sales, quantitative analysis, project delivery and development, while maintaining a static corporate cost structure. Fifth, we've introduced robust risk management techniques to support our contracting strategy. These include a combination of demand-side management into the contract arrangements, accessing the derivatives market to defend against price movements during periods of low production, and managing our commitments across the portfolio as a whole. Sixth, we've replaced our legacy global debt facility with a new Australian term loan, enabling us to operate the assets as an integrated business. We've also obtained related facilities to address the daily business need for working capital and to provide credit support where required. Seventh, we've reduced our debt by $131 million, excluding the Budangaroo project finance debt as a part of the refinancing. By the end of the term, we will have further reduced the debt supporting those assets by a minimum of $160 million. Eighth, we've contracted 42% of our energy produced under supply contracts to C&I customers, and to date successfully performed under those contracts to meet our obligations. As a result, We've stabilized our earnings over the medium term. Sounds like another CNI customer phoning in. This has buttressed our capital structure and has given us confidence that our strategy can deliver value to our company and its security holders. Ninth, we've invested $28 million in a 25-megawatt lithium-ion battery in South Australia. The business case for this investment was strengthened by our successful application for $10 million in grant funding from the South Australian and Commonwealth governments. The project is currently under construction and at this stage on time and on budget. We expect the battery to be fully commissioned by Q4 FY19. This will enable us to contract at least a further 18 megawatts of production from our Lake Bonnie assets. Finally, in FY19, we expect that we will receive an averaged bundle price for production we generate of $125 to $130 per megawatt hour. We believe, therefore, that we've made significant progress in delivering on our strategy. That said, we live in interesting and uncertain times. Hence, decisions concerning the future direction of our business strategy remain under constant review to take account of the forces that are likely to influence the future market conditions. There are a number of factors that influence these conditions. Two of these I wish to discuss today as they help explain the way in which we are attempting to position the company in that market to best protect existing and grow future security holder value. First, I wish to discuss the influence of dynamics in the market that, in our view, impact the future pricing of both energy and LGCs. A significant factor in this regard is the change in the relative cost of producing energy from differing technologies and fuel types capable of performing different functions in the market. Modelling pricing outcomes from an already complex set of calibrations is complicated by the social and political implications of the transformational process that is occurring in our industry. It's also further challenged by the need to see past political rhetoric to sensibly anticipate the cost of climate change and the likely role that energy generation should play in a strategy to reduce our global emissions. The pace of this transformation and the related investment in new infrastructure throughout the generation, transmission and distribution sectors required to facilitate it presents significant engineering, operational and financing challenges to all market participants. Accurately forecasting future energy prices and the potential future value of emissions is a complex mix of maths, science, art and wisdom. It's therefore critical that serious thought is accorded to the task of forecasting prices, especially with reference to new entrant costs and total system needs in the current set of conditions. While it's true that the cost of producing energy from wind and solar has declined to a point where the per unit cost of energy is lower than other technologies, this development does not translate directly into system wholesale prices. The power system requires a mix of generation as it always has done, with plant required for base load, intermediate load, peaking and reserve duties. Currently, the NEM sets prices every 5 minutes, with settlements averaged across the half hour to determine the spot price. In 2021, this will be changed so that the 5 minute price becomes the settlement price. Actual power flows must, of course, match demand on the microsecond. The NEM 5 minute market price is set by the plant at the margin that can respond to incremental changes in demand. This needs to be plant that is flexible, that is, providing dispatchable generation to meet fluctuating demand. As we've already seen in South Australia, the price in the market will be set by flexible plant and excess non-flexible energy will be constrained off. The growth in renewable energy, both in front of and behind the meter, has altered the duty required of the remainder of the plant in the system. The lower cost of renewable energy versus energy generated from fossil fuels means that the further growth in renewable generation is inevitable. To match this, the system will need a growing number of flexible dispatchable plants. New plants with these characteristics include batteries, gas turbine, pump storage hydro, and at higher load factors, combined cycle gas turbines. Of course, the progressive introduction of more renewable energy will be matched by reduced amounts generated by existing thermal plant. Thermal generators will accordingly adjust their fuel purchase commitments to match anticipated production schedules, and ultimately we expect the mix of renewables a new flexible dispatchable plant to replace the ageing legacy coal plants, which have relatively low flexibility. Prices for the power system will therefore continue to be set by flexible dispatchable plants, that is, gas, legacy coal plants, or energy-limited hydro plants. The price of thermal generation is now linked to export prices, which remain strong. In short, pricing for system power referenced only to the cost of run-of-plant production from renewables does not reflect the cost of supplying energy that responds to customer needs, so-called firm, or more recently, fair dinkum energy. In the midterm, even without taking account of emission reductions goals, it's difficult to see a role in the power system for any new high load factor plant, absent government intervention. In our view, actions by government which underwrite the entry of such plant or artificially prolong their life will displace generation from other existing coal plants and hasten their retirement. These actions can only further undermine investor confidence in the integrity of our market, potentially at significant cost to taxpayers and consumers. Unfortunately, however, in the current set of political conditions, the prospect of this occurring seems possible. It's in this context that we consider the likely future price of wholesale energy, setting aside unknown interventions by government. One view in the market that has gained currency is that the cost of new generation equals generation plus firming from an OCGT. That is approximately $75 to $80 a megawatt hour. This thesis is, however, reliant on the availability of baseload or mid-merit generation from within the system more broadly to supply any shortfall in generation. For the reasons discussed earlier, as ageing coal plants progressively exit, this will need to be logically met by a combined cycle gas turbine, certainly once an OCGT is required to run more than around 30% of the time. Hence, combined cycle gas turbines will become the benchmark new entrant price. Given an assumed gas price of $8.50 a gigajoule, this leads to a new entrant wholesale price of electricity of about $90 a megawatt hour. At $10 gas, the wholesale energy price would rise to $100 a megawatt hour. The direction of change is relatively clear. The rate of change is less predictable. It would be hastened by obligations for stronger emissions targets for the electricity sector, or potentially slowed by interventionist actions of government. Assessing the value, if any, of LGCs or lower emission generation in this market is a challenging exercise due to the uncertainty about the likely amount of additional supply of renewable energy entering the market between now and 2030. Predicting the rate of new entrant plant into the market is a complex enough challenge before factoring in the implications of a growing divergence in political positions around the future policy treatment of greenhouse gas emissions, specifically, and energy policy more generally. I'll deal first with the factors that influence the supply side of the LGC price equation. It's widely reported that there are many renewable projects that have been announced for future development, indeed in excess of that required to deliver the 2020 RET target. However, the level of certainty of those projects all completing in the near term is in some measure of doubt. There are a number of factors which can be expected to influence the amount of new renewable projects which will ultimately enter the market, limiting the risk of excessive investment. These include a shrinking market for long-term PPAs, a more cautious approach by lenders, an increasing requirement from investors for equity returns to reflect heightened risk profiles, the emerging implications of grid stability issues in the cost structure of renewable projects, as well as the time taken to reach financial close, the emerging implications for power system reliability, as reflected in the reliability obligation proposed in the NEG, growing awareness of the risks of being constrained off in the event of excess renewable generation, as well as potential future reduced revenues due to negative adjustments to marginal loss factor calculations, and a growing awareness of the impact of potential oversupply of solar on spot prices during periods of peak solar production. Beyond the general factors discussed above that are likely to impact the pace and scale of new entrant renewable generation, there are other dynamics at work in the market that also impact the supply side the supply and demand equation for LGCs, hence impacting price. These include the onset of drought conditions in eastern Australia may result in reduced LGC production from the hydro generators. LGCs are controlled by market participants who will generally behave in a commercially rational manner to protect the value of their past investments. And the additional requirements of green power, some state-based initiatives, the operation of the desalination plants, and the need for the LGC inventory to protect against supply imbalance over time. In the light of the importance of government policy settings to the cost of the emissions, it is necessary to say a little more about the implications of the major parties' policies. The LNP policy is at present to retain a commitment to achieving the Paris target, but to rely upon the energy sector to deliver only its proportional contribution to emissions reductions. Hence, the LNP policy will not offer additional momentum to invest in renewables, at least as far as the emissions reduction goals are concerned. That said, there has been little or no indication of new policy initiatives to enable other key contributors to greenhouse gas emissions, namely the transport and agricultural sectors, to achieve their targets. This is a puzzling policy stance, given that the electricity sector is among the most flexible industries in terms of its ability to introduce new low emissions technologies at a relatively low cost and speed compared to other sectors. The LNP policy of underwriting dispatchable plant appears to be a policy that is really directed towards the proponents of new coal-fired power plant or life extensions to old coal-fired plant. Should it gain traction, this will likely check the decision-making timetable of a number of proposed renewable projects. It could also reduce the investment proposals for new renewable generation to replace retiring thermal plant, such as the Liddell Power Station, hence reducing the number of LGCs entering the market as a byproduct of energy production. The Federal Opposition's policy, in contrast, seems to contemplate flexibility and lower transaction costs in reducing emissions from these other industry sectors by a commitment to a higher emissions target for the electricity sector. In our view, the path to meeting Australia's overall emissions target will be less costly and more socially palatable if the stationary energy sector contributes disproportionately to achieving this goal. Such an approach is likely to boost investment in renewables as the market gains confidence that the cost of reducing emissions will be reflected in future pricing. What all this means in terms of market structure and the specific instruments required to guide market behaviour is hard to foresee at present, but in due course, these will need to emerge. In the short to medium term, the efficacy of the system can be maintained by gas or hydro performing a similar function to coal, supported by renewables. But in the longer run, appropriate policy mechanisms will be required if the system plant stock is to be reshaped to deliver an accelerated and sustained decline in emissions. There are many policy instruments available to policymakers. These include renewable and clean energy targets, schemes, emissions trading schemes, including emissions intensity schemes or cap and trade schemes, portfolio standards or an emissions obligation like that envisaged in the NEG, regulatory emissions standards, forced plant closures, carbon taxes, and so on. Any of these policy mechanisms should ultimately place a value on CO2 emissions, either explicitly or implicitly. Recognising this reality, modelling agencies generally cite a value of between $20 and $30 a tonne in order to meet the quantity constraints arising from Australia's Paris commitments. From our perspective, we consider the bundle value of all revenue streams. We assume a base case of the new entrant price for energy going forward, together with the cost of securing sufficient firming to manage risks in supplying our C&I customer needs as the relevant price. The value of LGCs will inevitably decline as the RET is met. The rate of decline will be influenced by the pace of renewables continuing to enter the market once the RET is achieved. Accordingly, we assume a modest value for LGCs going forward as proxy value or of an implicit or explicit price on the externalities associated with producing power from non-renewable sources. I wish to now offer some comment on the impact of the political environment on Infogen's future business strategy. While market fundamentals are critically important, they can be distorted by the policy environment in which our industry operates. Discouragingly, for more than a decade, energy policy has been a battleground. At the current time, energy policy has been reduced by some commentators to little more than an irresponsibly simplistic argument over the purported relative merits of coal-fired generation and renewables. Over the course of the last 12 months, the national energy debate has seemingly produced more fake news than any other single issue. Even more disappointing is the fact that simplistic and often erroneous or misleading claims continue to influence the shape of policy direction. This is despite the effort that industry experts and sensible policymakers have made over the last 2 years. They've worked hard to design a framework to support a healthy market, to support a healthy market-based response that would meet the community expectations for a system that reliably produces competitively priced energy in a way that reduces the level of greenhouse gas emissions. In the current set of political conditions, it's difficult to see a return to responsible policy design until we have a more stable political environment. Hopefully, this will be accompanied by a bipartisan realisation that it is in the country's best interests that at a broad range of levels to adopt a consistent and focused vision on how to best meet our long-term energy needs. The long-term vision for Australia's energy industry should logically reflect the fact that we are blessed with an abundant supply of renewable as well as non-renewable resources. If efficiently harnessed as a nation, this places us in an enviable position. Our ability to capture the opportunities this presents in the short and long run as part of the long-term transition of our industry should be a shared goal for all political parties. To deliver a robust energy supply system in the future, it will also be necessary to address the growing challenges with the transmission and distribution networks. This points to the need for a national strategy to facilitate investment by the networks in grid expansion and system strength. In circumstances where the patronage risk associated with building arterial transmission and distribution infrastructure is beyond the appetite of most private sector investors. Any viable long-term framework needs to be carefully structured and calibrated to enable the industry to deliver the optimal outcome for both investors and consumers. The NEG seemed to offer a pathway forward, although it was not a panacea. The jury remains out on whether a policy phoenix can arise from the smouldering remains of the NEG. From our perspective, any effective policy that can provide sustainable long-term outcomes should be delivered through market-based principles rather than direct government intervention. In all these circumstances, Infogen has considered its strategy carefully and the capital requirements to support it. While we are monitoring the policy environment closely and take careful account of the currents of opinion within it, we believe that underlying market fundamentals should continue to underpin the business strategy we have adopted. Bearing this in mind, first, we plan to maintain pursuit of our strategy to supply clean energy solutions to a growing base of commercial and industrial customers. To this end, we will look to expand our customer base through a more sophisticated billing system that enables us to service customers with multiple sites. Second, we will pursue opportunities for additional investment in firming capacity, particularly in South Australia and New South Wales. This will enable us to manage our own risk profile as well as enter further C&I supply contracts. It will also enable us to generate revenues from the evolving changes in the market that will or are expected to reward services that reduce system volatility or instability. Third, we will selectively procure additional renewable generation capacity in key regional markets, with a preference for this to be delivered via a capital light model where appropriate. We continue to advance our Cherry Tree development project via this model, and so too do we look to develop our Flyers Creek project in New South Wales as a candidate project for a capital light funding strategy. Fourth, we plan to reduce leverage to ensure ready refinancing of our debt before it falls due and to enhance the quality of our credit. Fifth, we expect to introduce a sustainable dividend distributions policy to address the expectation of certain existing investors and to hopefully meet the investment criteria of a broader base of potential future investors. Capital management to support our business plan is therefore a critical component of our overall corporate strategy. Under current and reasonably assumed future market conditions, our business is producing and will continue to produce levels of free cash flow that will address a number, but not all, of our business objectives over the short to medium term. Our current approach to capital allocation is based on the assumption that the first calls on our available cash reserves will be directed towards ensuring that we maintain a sustainable debt structure over time, as well as preserve capital to pursue value-accretive strategic growth options. Subject to the availability of free cash beyond meeting those goals, we would propose to return value to security holders. I know there are a number of security holders who argue that the company should consider initiating a buyback of securities instead of paying a distribution or investing in growth. Until today, assuming that security holders vote in favour of the resolution to destaple the Bermuda companies, this option has not been available to Infigen. Subject to the outcome of today's vote, this will hopefully become an option for the board to consider in the future. The board appreciates the relative merits of a buyback and will no doubt consider the circumstances in which a buyback may be appropriate. The option to introduce a buyback will need to be considered in the hierarchy of calls on our capital to support our corporate strategy in the short, medium and long term. As previously advised to the market, the company continues to explore various options available to source capital to support the business strategy at a pace that enables us to create maximum value for security holders. To this end, we remain in discussion with the Brookfield Group about the role they might play in this regard. We've also considered other proposals that have been advanced by various parties that would involve investment at the asset level in new capacity. We evaluate these proposals to assess whether they are in the best interests of the company and for the benefit of all security holders. If we reach a position where we believe that a proposal meets these criteria, we would naturally inform the market as appropriate. In summary, we've had a good year in terms of financial outcomes. We've had a good year in terms of the financial outcomes we've produced and the progress we've made in delivering our strategy to position Infigen as a sustainable business supplying clean energy solutions to our growing C&I customer base. But there's still more to be done. Our capital strategy is designed to enable us to maintain progress towards our long-term goal while taking account of the risks and opportunities that the future market contains. By maintaining focus on the overarching objective while prudently responding to challenges as they emerge and capturing the opportunities that might arise, we hope that we will be able to deliver growing value to our security holders. Thank you for taking the time to attend today, for your interest that you've taken in our company, and for your support for it. I'll now return you to Len.
Thanks for your attention to both Ross and my address. They probably by board standards were longer than average. But we thought it was very important that we give shareholders a deeper understanding of the dynamics that are at work at the energy market and our thinking and why we think our business strategy will be robust as we meander our way through the mire of Australian energy policy. I'm going to now turn to the formal business of the meeting, and in doing so, refer you to the notice of meeting. The first item on the notice of meeting is to receive and consider the combined financial report of Infigen Energy and the financial report of the Trust, as well as the combined reports of the directors and auditor for the year ended 30 June 2018. These reports have been distributed to security holders, and I now table them. David has them. No resolution or vote is required in relation to the financial reports, but discussion is welcome. Mr. Mark Upcroft from our auditor, PwC, is here to answer any audit-related questions which you may have. I'd like to confine the first set of questions to the financial report, and then I propose to open up to a broader range of questions. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the financial and other reports? Please raise your hand and wait for a microphone. And at this stage, as I say, please confine your questions to the financial report, and if you could identify yourself as well, please. Are there any questions on the financial report? Okay, well, I'm now going to open it up to other questions on other matters. I'll progressively cover the remuneration one and so forth, but can we have a microphone?
Thank you. My name is Antoinette Grant. I'm a long-term shareholder from the very beginning. I thank you very much for the extensive information, even though in general one is informed. And I just wanted to really know, is the company doing anything to oppose the, what I would call the idiocy of short-term political intervention in the market, apart from agreeing with most other energy producers? Is there any opposition to the completely stupid short-term solutions that the government would think about the big stick? But before you answer that question, just to be balanced in my statements, I would just say the idiocy of you wanting to change the short-term and long-term remuneration, I consider that of similar idiocy, because it's the long-term solutions that should be progressed and not the short-term solutions. So, but my question actually is there anything that the companies can do to really oppose this constant barrage of just wanting to lower electricity prices at no consideration of anything else?
I'll make a few remarks and then I'm going to ask Ross to expand. I guess, you know, we need to recognise that, you know, we operate under a political system where ultimately voters get to determine which party is in and therefore which policies they adopt. Our business has to and has learnt to operate with uncertainty from all political parties. I don't know, Miles George is here and I'll see him nod in a minute, because we've had uncertainty on energy policy for a decade or more. And this business has continued to work its way through those, and more particularly I think of recent times we've got a business model that's adapting to the changing future in front of us. So short of making our views known in a polite and respectful way and ensuring that we and others, particularly investors, make sure the government understands the consequences of their policies, there's probably ultimately the test will be whether these policies prove popular at the ballot box or whether they perhaps get the judgment they deserve. Ross, I'm going to throw to you.
Yeah, sure. Look, we are very actively involved in that policy design process as best we can, and we've had a long tradition of it. As Len said, Miles, when he was MD, did an amazing job influencing the RET policy outcome that emerged in 2015. And since then, there's been, you know, a bunch of processes, the Finkel Review, the work of the Energy Security Board, and we've actively participated in that, both as a company and through the industry associations, in particular the Clean Energy Council and the Australian Energy Council. So we're as active as we can be and make our views well known. I guess we all thought that for all its possible shortcomings, the National Energy Guarantee process was a pretty good framework that was, at least with some more detail, going to offer sort of hope for a sensible future that had broadly bipartisan support. That seems to have now gone off the rails. Where things will emerge going forward is probably more difficult to predict. You know, some of the work that the ACCC did, I think has some sensible ideas within it. Unfortunately, it seems those ideas have been sort of kidnapped and had their identity changed in the government policy making process at the moment. So how they actually unfold remains to be seen. But beyond sort of moonlighting with a gig on Sky News, I'm not sure how more influential we can be in that process or more active we can be.
It could be a bit more vigorous. It doesn't have to be rude or impolite. It could be more vigorous. And I think, in general, industry is right on your side. And you should, you could maybe combine with a lot of people outside the actual industry, because everybody knows the way forward is going to be what you said it's going to be. And the other thing is, you could also emphasize a bit more how beneficial it would be to Australia to not be on the back foot of this. For example, China does heaps more things and already sells all sorts of things to other countries because they obviously have got a bigger pollution problem than we have, but they are also much more forward in actually doing things. And Australia always seems to sort of come, and not looking at what the best policy is around the world to actually go forward, because there's other countries that do heaps of solar, and Australia should be in the forefront of all of these things, because we have the place, we have the room for renewables, for wind farms, for solar, the whole bit, really. So there's no reason for Australia to be so backward, really.
Thank you.
So, but thank you for your aims, because I approve of all the aims except for the payment issue. And it would be nice if we eventually got some sort of dividend. Thank you. Oh, and just because I won't put another question after this, if everything gets agreed with the securities, could you maybe put out a statement that will help with taxation issues for people who have had the shares from the very beginning? So you know what capital gains you might have to declare, etc.
Can I take that question on notice without providing any detail?
Thank you very much.
It's time for us to hear from other shareholders, other security holders. If you could please identify yourself.
Fred Woolard, shareholder. There was talk during the presentations about this capital light funding model for future developments. Interested to hear more about precisely how that might work.
Ross, Sylvia, who wants to take the lead on that?
Sure. Well, I guess we started to look at that model when we saw some very low prices for PPAs coming into the market a year or so ago. And part of that was really as a result of entities with a lower cost of funds than we have, in some cases through equipment manufacturers. So I guess we sort of saw that as an alternative option available to us to sort of contract supply rather than necessarily sort of build on balance sheet. There are obviously advantages and disadvantages with each approach. One benefit, I guess, with the capital light approach is, you know, you're not making a commitment for the full life of the asset. So our Kiata offtake agreement, it's really a five-year tenor, and we get to sort of review the position at that point. In the case of Cherry Tree, we're looking for a longer tenor than that. But it still means that we get the sort of full benefit of the production, really, while we hold the PPA, but potentially at using somebody else's lower cost of capital. Do you want to add to that, Sylvia?
Are there any other questions? Just one down the front here.
Kaz, I'm also a foundation shareholder. Overall, you have projected a very positive growth and income path. The government may be wavering. why isn't the market listening to what you're saying, accepting it, and being reflected in the share price? And there's something, some disconnect somewhere. If your message is sound, government will, it's playing populism at the moment, whatever it suits. There's no policy, there's a whole range of things. I mean, we won't go there. But all I'm saying is, if your message is good as it sounds, why isn't the market listening to it and responding in what I would say is a fair price?
There's a couple of inferences in your question. And one is, our society thrives on having divergent points of view put forward in our media and poured over and expanded, debated. So there's a lot of noise around issues, and energy has a lot of noise around it and has had for some years. So we operate in a market in which there's a lot of external noise. Electricity is very confusing. It's not a simple industry. It's not a simple commodity. We've seen there are numerous examples of that, including, the obfuscation that is retail pricing. So we sort of operate in a very noisy environment. The second is, I think you need to sort of reflect that in terms of our new strategy, it's still early days. I certainly agree with the sentiment of why isn't the share market reflecting our strategy, but it is what it is. The best thing that we can do is to continue to perform. I mean, today we're outlining we're continuing to throw off good cash. We've continued this year to identify firming. We're continuing to grow our C&I base. We've got a wind farm that's going to give 24% more production. And I think as we continue to throw off good results, and show that our model will steer its way through the noisy external environment, I would hope that we would get the appropriate recognition in the market. But I agree, it's difficult at the moment to see through the fog. And I see, pretty much all energy stocks are down, largely because there's a big stick kind of hanging over the whole sector. Follow up. I will allow one follow up. Do you have a follow up, sir?
Yes, I do.
Sorry, it's coming from the other direction.
Sorry.
That tricked you.
I was just going to say, the punters in the market are smart enough, and if they agree with what you're saying and your strategy, they would see this as a great opportunity to buy in. But nobody's buying in. And there was a rights issue, or whatever it was, 87 cents. The price is now halved. So we were still going down in the other direction. I mean, I know there's no simple answers. I accept the notion that we are a society that makes choices on what is being offered by the government, and quite often, more often than not, what they're sort of obfuscating about. But I'm saying in the financial market, surely there must be punters saying, look, this looks good value, let's go and buy something in. And that buying is not taking place, and the share price just keeps going in the other direction. Having paid 87 cents for the rights issue, the price is almost halved. So there must be some disconnect somewhere. Either it's in your message or what you're doing, or the punters saying, well, it's not good value, and let's leaving dogs lie, so to speak.
Okay. Ross, did you want to make a few comments on
that? Sure. Just a couple of comments. One is, when you look at sort of how our share price performance over time, it really is incredibly responsive to what the market's forward view of the underlying commodity is, namely the price of energy going forward and LGCs. And you will have seen a lot of speculation in the market about what's happening on those prices, and when you track it, it's quite closely correlated. It is impacted on certain events that occur in the market. So obviously the current energy debate and what happened a few months ago there was one significant effect. But the other thing, I guess, which, and this is not By any means the full explanation, so I'm not trying to suggest it is, but you might have noticed that over the last sort of 6 months or so, we have been subject to an increasingly aggressive shorting strategy in our stock, which has, you know, really driven the price down. Not a lot we can do about that. It's a legal course of action. There's not too many ways in which you can address that, other than through, I guess, maintaining faith in, the strategy that we've got, and demonstrating, you know, proof of concept, which is what we've been trying to do.
There was another question down there. Yep. Thank you.
Anthony Pesek, shareholder. Whilst we wait for, I think, an imminent Labor government with presumably a pro-renewables policy, there's still an energy a policy vacuum here in Australia, which is, I think, the biggest concern to all of us. Ross, you spoke a lot about LGCs, and obviously these policies, whatever they might be in the future, will have an effect on the LGC, which is a big component of your income. A few days ago, we had some very good news with CBA joining the RE100, which is a global initiative for companies to source 100% of their energy from renewable energy sources. What is your gut feel with regard to the future of more companies joining up with this initiative and taking LGCs off the market that would otherwise perhaps be converted under the LGC scheme? I'm hoping that this could be a big driver for demand for renewable energy projects. So I don't know how much of an effect the CBA deal alone had, but there's certainly plenty more companies. They're the first one in Australia to have joined this list, and there's a lot of big names on this list globally. So we're hoping that there's going to be a lot more of this to come, and how much of an impact could that have?
Rush, do you want to
comment? It's a very good question, and look, I'm sort of been hopelessly incompetent at predicting future market behaviour. So what the effect of that's going to be, I'm not really sure. But what I will say is we've been really encouraged by the sort of growing appetite in the sort of business sector generally to engage directly on the supply of renewable energy. Of course, price matters, and we need to be meeting the market there, but you know, the brand benefit of renewables is something which increasingly the customer base that we work with is valuing significantly, and we are seeing that appetite grow. So at the moment, we're not seeing any sort of dissipation in demand for our products, both energy and LGCs, although the outlook on LGC pricing is, as I mentioned earlier, sort of in decline. We probably see that being offset to some extent by the price of energy for the reasons I went into in the speech. Yeah, Sylvie might want to...
Hi, Anthony. Just one further comment on the effect of RE100. I think what we've certainly seen out of the US is its industry taking control, exactly as Ms. Grant was talking about earlier, where we can actually see industry trying to replace government policy where it's failed. And I think where it's been very effective in the US is where some of the very significant companies like Apple and Google are actually putting pressure on their supply chains to also sign up to those types of initiatives. So that's where, you know, getting the really big names like CBA and other, if we can get manufacturing and industrial in this country, I think that will be a very significant sort of game changer. Because we've seen that be very effective, you know, when you think about labour laws, where sort of big companies like Qantas, for example, have very significant deep dives into where their supply chains to make sure that people are complying with laws and have appropriate governance down there. That's where I think RE100 can be very effective, not only with the use of individuals, but whether they will actually dive down into supply chains. And we've certainly seen that in the US. So fingers crossed, but that's where it can be very effective in the failure of government policy.
Okay. Start with the one down the front, if that's all right, and then we'll go to the gentleman in the middle.
Hi, Alfred Woolard again. Three of our wind farms are now more than 10 years old. A few years ago, people used to say that wind farm turbines had a useful life of in the order of 25 years. Now that we're getting towards halfway to that life, interested to hear your current views on the expected life of our older turbines, and our newer ones for that matter.
Good question. Ross?
Yes, sure. Well, I might also let Sylvia comment on it, but there has been, an industry and OEM view, which we share, that the historic, actually really more 20 years, although we depreciate our assets over 25, but there has been an increasing view that 30 years is a reasonable life expectancy. And as part of the O&M work, part of the work we did on our new O&M services agreement, we had DNVGL do a very thorough analysis of all our existing assets, and I guess we got a fair degree of confidence from that our assets have been very well maintained. The new regime that we have for O&M should ensure that they are maintained at that standard for up until their 20th birthday, and we should reasonably be able to expect that they will approach 30 years. Certainly at present, we still work on 25 years, but the industry generally accepts that they're more likely to go to at least 30.
And we reflect that in our accounts. When the original assets were put into the books, they were being depreciated over 20 years. Now all our existing assets are depreciated over 25 years, and Badangara will be depreciated over 30 years. That's consistent with our expectation of its design life. And as Ross said, from an internal perspective, out of the DNVGL work that he referred to, we've actually now got an operating cost model internally that actually manages those assets to a 30-year life, with the expectation that for the older assets between 25 and 30, we won't really see so much declines in productivity of a wind farm. What you will see is failure of an individual turbine on site, where it's no longer financially, economically rational to actually repair that one turbine. So you'll see production decline, but by reference to sort of single points of failure across that 25 to 30 year life in respect of the existing wind farms, as I said, Badangara 30 years. And we've been putting, as Ross and Len referred to in their speeches, a lot of work into both the Cherry Tree Wind Farm and Ross mentioned Flyers Creek Wind Farm, which is in New South Wales, and all the lives that we're looking at there coming out of the OEMs are now 30 years. And that's where they'll also give you 30-year OEM contracts in respect of that. So I think as the technologies become more mature, as Ross said, people have got greater confidence about the design lives of these assets. So we remain very confident around that.
OK, gentlemen.
The CBA initiative is terrific and positive. I mean, it might shape policy, which is great, and take it out of the hands of the government. What about some of those companies that are now beginning to generate their own energy? About 4 years ago, SCA and GPT, I asked, what use were they putting their miles of roof space to? Not one had a single solar panel. I understand now, 3 or 4 years later, that they're generating quite a substantial amount and are leading. So what negative impact is that likely to have? Potential impact, I'm not saying it's going to have a direct effect. Does that negate some of the other initiatives from companies like CBA, for example?
Do you want me to answer that?
Yeah.
Look, at the moment, I mean, it's a bit hard to sort of tell in the longer run what the outworking of that might be, but at present we're finding that there is an appetite on certain large CNI customers to have a component of their generation produced from rooftop solar that they own and invest in. But they're also likely to come to us, as many of them currently are, about how they manage the sort of intermittency of supply risk around that, and also source other generation from, you know, wind, which might have a complementary production profile to their solar. So actually those customers at present those businesses at present are actually quite, they're in our sort of zone of customer interest because they are already thinking about how they manage their energy cost and supply risk going forward. Now that might change over time, but at present it seems to be, you know, a positive development in the market.
Either of those two companies approached you in any sense?
A big base.
Have those two companies, SCA and GPT, who apparently are generating a fair proportion of their energy from roof space, you know, photovoltaic, solar cells on their roof, generating quite a substantial amount of energy, have they approached you in seeking to have you manage or maintain or do anything?
Look, I'm not aware of those two particular companies that we're involved with, but I'd probably have to ask our sales guys as to whether we've had involvement with them.
Okay. I just thought I'd read somewhere that they are fairly substantial leaders now, 4 years after I'd first asked the question, in generating energy. I think there were some issues with feeding the networks or something or other, but other than that, they'd taken the initiative and they were running with it.
Right.
Not only reduce the carbon footprint, but also their energy prices costs, which makes sense.
Well, I see one of our guys in the room who has the customer interface. So after the AGM, I'll go and talk to him. And if we haven't engaged with him, we will.
Good. Thank you.
Question here.
Sorry, Rob Pilot. You mentioned that the battery storage will be up and operational at the end of this financial year. What are the plans for more battery storage, first? And the second, there is varying technology regarding battery storage. Can you sort of make a couple of comments around, you know, competing technologies?
Well, I'll handle the first part of the question and then handball the hard part to Ross and his team. Look, I think we've made it clear in our presentation today that we are looking for more opportunities for firming, and that clearly includes batteries. But it's not exclusive to batteries. We think there's a range of potential products that will provide that. And I guess we also see that as a growing market needed for that sort of flexible, fast response plant. As the sort of legacy coal plants come off, the system's going to require a more flexible plant. I think that was one of our key messages today. Now, in terms of the various battery technologies, I'm going to look perhaps to Ross and maybe straight to Paul, are we? Who's done them?
Well, I'll make a couple of comments and then we'll go to the in-house battery expert. But so when we think about firming capacities and the role of batteries in that process, we tend to think about what's happening in the specific regional market. So in South Australia, with, you know, their particular configuration of plant and the performance of their wind resource, a battery makes particular sense because of its ability to react immediately to market conditions, and also because it has the ability to help address system stability issues such as, you know, those arising from, you know, the sort of ancillary services, frequency control and ancillary services market. New South Wales or Victoria, we probably don't think there's such a strong case in that market for a battery. And a battery, of course, has a quite limited function. So as Len said, when we think about firming capacity going forward, we also think about in combination with other sorts of firming, like, for example, you know, an open cycle gas turbine or, you know, maybe pumped storage hydro. Or in some markets, you can actually access really that through a derivative product where it might make more sense. But why we chose the lithium-ion battery for South Australia was really because of its fast response capability, whereas a vanadium battery, for example, doesn't have the same degradation issues that lithium ion has, but it can't react as quickly in the marketplace. So when we looked at the range of technologies that were available, the cost of those technologies, and quite frankly, in South Australia, the fact that the Hornsdale battery was performing and was performing actually better than expected by anyone was a sort of another factor. We had in the market a battery that was doing what we needed to be able to do, and it was sort of proven. So that was, I suppose, the number of issues we took into account there. But Paul, do you want to add anything to it?
Seven different battery types and suppliers, and the battery we selected was unambiguously the most suited for the reasons that Ross has outlined in terms of cost and performance. The other observation I'd make is that when we went back several months later to go and test the market, we noticed that the market had moved materially upwards in terms of cost. I'm no doubt that manufacturing costs have gone down, but demand has gone up, and the battery manufacturers obviously need to make a buck as well, so that the price has gone up. I'd love to tell you was our brilliant sort of foresight that's got us that lower cost battery, but in truth, we hit the market at a really good time. The dollar was in a good place and a good state. So we feel like we've got ourselves our hands on a really, really good piece of equipment at a great time, and of course with important support from two layers of government, Commonwealth and state. Batteries are still, they're going to need support in our market. They're not economic in their own right just yet. The other thing that's probably worthwhile is flagging, and it goes to the very heart of the matter that Ross flagged in terms of performance. Interestingly enough, with the batteries, their real value is not so much sort of charging and discharging, but being able to respond very quickly with small amounts of energy at the right times, hitting what we call our frequency control ancillary service market. So it's almost like what traditional generators would call spinning reserves, being able to respond in real time or within a 6-second time frame to shocks to the system, and that's where they really make quite a lot of their economic value as a business.
Question on my right.
My name is Patrick Conning, and I'm a shareholder. Two questions. The first one, assuming that we still have the contract to supply power to the Sydney Desal plant, do we have that? Which has not been running at full capacity, as I understand it, for quite a while. In the context of the onset of another drought and the need to run that Desal plant at full capacity, would we be able to accommodate the demand, the power demand of that without firming or without buying power from somewhere else? That's my first question.
Yeah, no, well, we've managed that that contract for, since 2011, I think, Miles. So actually, drought conditions and the desal plant running, as far as we're concerned, is a good thing, because the amount of LGCs that we then supply rise from 180,000 a year to 270,000. Yeah, 360, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's 270. Anyway, it's a good thing in terms of the amount of LGCs that that it absorbs, and we manage the sort of energy supply risk in accordance with, I guess, our sort of our general sort of trading behaviours in the market, and we've done so for quite a long time. It's a liquid market in which it's sort of quite readily manageable.
That power supply was, as I recall, came from the Capital Wind Fund, didn't it?
Yeah.
Now, if Capital was in a slow wind sort of situation and Batangora was not, would we be able to supply that power from any other wind farms that were available? Or is that contract just limited
It's not a physical supply arrangement. The desal plant draws the energy off the grid, so what we're exposed to is sort of price fluctuations
in that market, which we can either manage by sort of reference to our production from other New South Wales plant, such as Pedangra, or we can buy caps in the market.
My other question concerns whether or not Infigen tendered into any of the recent big calls for new build-out of renewables, such as the Victorian government scheme and the Snowy Mountains scheme. I was hoping, looking at the news, that I might see some news there about Infigen being successful and tendering in there, but I haven't seen anything. Are you able to tell us if you did were able to tender?
We did tender into the VRET process. We didn't with Snowy. But to be honest, the sort of prices that were achieved in that process are not ones that we would be creating value for you as a security holder if we had bid in at that price. So we were only bidding on the basis of if we get a fair and reasonable price that delivers value back to our security holders, we'd be happy, but we have other markets that we can sell into without necessarily doing that. So yeah, we did bid, but we didn't win.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions at this time, I'm going to move into the issues requiring a security holder vote. Before we proceed in with voting, please note that in accordance with the voting exclusion statement on page 7 of the notice of meeting, a vote must not be cast for any resolution by or on behalf of those persons whose interests are affected directly by the resolution or by their closely related parties. However, a vote may still be cast by such people where the vote is cast by them as a valid directed proxy and the vote is not cast on behalf of an affected person or their closely related parties. For those proxies vested in the chairman, this means in accordance with the terms on the proxy form that undirected proxies will be voted in favour of the resolution. As stated in the notice of meeting, these voting exclusions apply to items 2, 5 and 6 to be considered today. And in relation to the method of voting on the resolutions before the meeting today, I plan to call a poll for each resolution. There will be time allocated towards the end of the meeting for security holders to complete their voting cards for collection by the scrutineer. And further instructions for the poll voting will be provided at that time. Item 2 seeks adoption of the remuneration report. This report is set out in the 2018 annual report from page 25, and this resolution is to be voted upon by the company. This vote is advisory and does not bind the directors of the Infigen entities, although your directors do value security holders' views and give them careful consideration when addressing policy changes. As mentioned earlier, FY18 was a year of transformation for Infigen, with management achieving a number of strategic objectives, including the successful refinancing of the legacy corporate debt facilities, advancing construction of the Pedangra wind farm, and implementation of the multi-channel route to market strategy. This resulted in senior management achieving short-term incentive outcomes as detailed in the remuneration report. There were no long-term incentives grants for testing or vesting during FY18 for the current executive key management personnel, none yet having achieved a tenure of 3 years. Director and committee fees remain unchanged throughout FY18, and as stated in the REM report, the board has agreed that director and committee fees will not be reviewed again until the board is satisfied that further progress has been made in the delivery of strategic objectives contained within the group's 5-year business plan. Infigen's board and management are committed to repositioning Infigen to meet the challenges and grasp the opportunities presented by the transition occurring in the Australian energy market. And it is within this context that Infigen's remuneration structure was reviewed by the board during the year. That review resulted in adjustments to the STI deferral conditions, a rebalancing of the short-term and long-term remuneration mix, and the operational performance condition of the FY19 LTI grant being updated to assess progress in implementing the group's 5-year business plan. The board believes these changes will result in Infigen's remuneration framework remaining market competitive and will continue to appropriately motivate and reward executives to deliver Infigen's business strategy. The resolution for item two is shown on the screen, which is to adopt the REM report, etc. The resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders willing voting to vote in favour of the resolution to be passed. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. And the directors recommend that security holders vote in favour of the adoption of the REM report. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the remuneration report? And I note we've had one comment made earlier. Are there any others? Gentleman to the right. Oh, sorry, I will come. And there's one on the left next.
Charles Weeks, I'm a long-term security holder, unfortunately. It seems to me as though we are making all the sacrifice. We're getting nothing, where other good people are still being well off from the company. I think you should reduce your pay by 50%. Give us a chance to get a bit of dividends. Thank you.
I'll take that. I'll just respond to that comment by saying we determine our remuneration in comparison with our benchmark peers. And whilst a proposition to reduce salary by 50% might be very welcome amongst some security holders, I suspect it would not provide the company with the calibre of the management team that's needed to actually really create value in the long term. So that would be my... But I note your sentiment.
I'll make the comment, but according to the OECD countries, our CEOs are very, very well off. All OECD countries are much lower than ours. Thank you.
Thank you. Question on the left...
Wendy Clare, shareholder. I scored these shares via Linter or Babcock and Brown somehow, but quite simply, if everything's so hunky-dory, directors getting paid as per the market, why the hell don't you pay a dividend, as if you can expect people to buy shares when there's no return? Similar to what the gentleman said.
Well, I think we have tried to explain that our priorities for the business are to further strengthen our balance sheet, so pay out our existing debt as we're required to, look at strengthening the balance sheet, in other words, further delevering, looking at some growth opportunities, and but we do believe that there's an appropriate review point after the annual results to consider what form, what's appropriate for a capital return in some form and what that form might be. Okay, if there are no further questions, for the purpose of voting, can you raise your hand? So for the purpose of voting exclusions, I noted a few minutes ago, the relevant persons who may not vote on this resolution are all key management personnel, including the directors and their closely related parties. And as foreshadowed in relation to voting on the adoption of the remuneration, I shall now call a poll on this item. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item two on your yellow voting card. I will now move on to item three on the agenda relating to the re-election of Mr. Philip Green as a director of two of the stapled entities, the company and the foreign company. As I indicated earlier in the meeting, Philip was unfortunately not able to travel to be present with us today. He's a nominee of our largest security holder, TCI. He's therefore a non-independent, non-executive director. And as mentioned, Phil was originally appointed to the board as a director in November 2010. And Phil is currently a member of Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. The other two committee members are independent directors. Proposed resolution is shown on the screen. The a resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour of the resolution to be passed. His background, Phil's background and experience are outlined in the notice of meeting. He holds qualifications in both engineering and accounting and has extensive experience across a number of industry sectors, including utilities, renewable energy and infrastructure investments. The other directors of Infogen recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the proposed re-election of Philip Green as a director? Oop, there's a one.
Can we have him say a few words via Skype?
I'm sorry, I didn't hand that.
I said, can we get Mr. Philip Green, seeing that he's been unable to attend, can we call him up and say, can you say a few words to the unit holders?
I think it's approximately...
I just thought it's an idea.
We might take it under advisement for a future year.
But civil, I will say
it's, you know, this is it's probably 2 or 3 in the morning where Philip is right now. So, and I think his credentials have been fairly well
I accept all that, but I'm saying there's nothing like having a few words said, either record a video or something to have a look. This is the reason why I'm doing, and this is how I propose to add value.
Thank you. I'll make that as a comment. Okay, I'll now call a poll on item 3 relating to re-election of Philip Green as a director. And again, you may wish to mark the relevant box for item 3 on your yellow voting card now, or you can wait till the end of the meeting. We will now move on to item 4 on the agenda, which is our first item of special business for the meeting. Item 4 relates to the stapling restructure proposal detailed in the notice of meeting, principally involving a reduction in the complexity of the group via the unstapling, delisting and capital reduction of the foreign company Infogen Energy Bermuda Limited. As outlined in the notice of meeting, the foreign company has not been used and it holds no assets of substance. Importantly, the Australian company and the Australian Trust will remain stapled and will continue to trade on the ASX as they do today, as Infogen Energy stapled securities. There's no decrease in assets or value of the continuing listed Infogen Energy Group. There are a number of benefits associated with the stapling restructure proposal outlined in the notice of meeting, including simplification of our corporate structure, simplification of the financial reporting arrangement requirements, reduced ongoing administrative and other costs associated with the foreign company, and a reduced regulatory burden on Infogen of having to comply with the laws of Bermuda in addition to our obligations under Australian law. As also stated in the notice, the disadvantage of undertaking the stapling restructure is the one-off costs of proposing and implementing the restructure, although these costs are not expected to be material. The directors consider that the advantages outweigh any disadvantages, and it is in the long-term best interests of the group and its security holders to proceed with the stapling restructure proposal. To ensure we meet with the Bermudan and Australian legal requirements, the restructuring proposal involves 5 separate resolutions, items 4A to 4E in the notice of meeting. As explained in the notice, those resolutions seek to approve the unstapling, delisting and capital restructure of the foreign company, and they also seek to make technical amendments to the constitutions and bylaws of the stapled entities, largely to remove references indicating that the foreign company is part of the Infogen stable security. And as stated in the notice, each of the resolutions in item 4 are proposed on the basis that they are interconditional. This means that the stapling restructure proposal will only proceed and these resolutions will only take effect if all the resolutions in items 4A to 4E are passed. The 5 resolutions in item 4 are special resolutions, which means at least 75% of the votes cast by security holders must be in favour of each resolution for it to be passed. Item 4A on the agenda is the initial approval of stapling restructure approval. This involves the approval to unstaple the shares issued by the foreign company from the shares and units issued by the Australian company and trust. This resolution also involves the approval to therefore after delist the shares issued by the foreign company from trading on the ASX. The proposed resolution for item 4A is as stated in the notice of meeting and is shown on the screen. I don't propose to read it. And this resolution is to be considered by the security holders of each of the company, foreign company and the trust. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any securities wish to ask questions or make a comment about the proposed approval to unstaple and delist the foreign company shares? Oop, got a couple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lance Grant. What are the cost savings advantage here? And I've got two other questions, and I'll give them to you at the same time. Is why with the foreign company will it be the convertible redeemable preference share be issued rather than just a straight ordinary share? And furthermore, if the company's got the foreign company's got no assets, why does it have to be wound up? Why can't it just be delisted and struck off the register? Thank you.
David or Sylvia?
It's working now. Just in relation to your first part, the cost savings, we haven't specifically reviewed the specific savings, but it'd be significant management time that is saved, significant costs from the legal advice we need to receive from Bermuda, the legal advice we need to receive in Australia dealing with a stapled security that involves an overseas company, and I guess the management distraction of having that Bermuda. As well, there is the issue that it restricts us doing certain things, having to comply with both sides of the Bermuda and Australian law. So I can't give you a specific number on the cost savings, but it is substantial and less of a distraction to management. Sorry, the second part of your question? Why is the convertible preference? I'll hand over to our legal advisers, Shannon Finch.
Shannon Finch from Kingwood and Allison. In working with the capital the stapling restructure, we needed to work with within the constraints of Bermuda law, and we assessed that. We were working within the constraints of Bermuda law, and we assessed that this process of cancelling the existing shares and internalising the company was the most efficient way of conducting the restructure and the most cost-effective way of conducting it. Firstly, as to why we're issuing a convertible preference share, it's simply because that way we fit within the Bermuda laws for cancelling all of the ordinary shares without creating a selective proposal that wouldn't be supported by Bermuda law. So the issuance of the convertible preference share allows us just a way of slotting the company in underneath the group in a very simple way. It doesn't affect the economics and it doesn't confer any actual benefit or particular preference on the group. It's expected that shortly after being internalised we'd convert that preference share into ordinary shares, so there will simply be a simple ownership structure between the Australian listed company and the Bermuda company as a subsidiary. So to the extent that we don't believe there is any value in the Bermuda entity for shareholders, but to the extent that it is still captured through your holding through the group structure. I think the second question was why do a winding up rather than simply striking it off? It's because, again, under Bermuda law, there isn't the opportunity or option of simply striking it off because it has no assets. We have to go through a winding up process. But that can be conducted in an orderly process after the company is internalised.
Thanks, Shen. As mentioned, the directors of the boards of the company, the foreign company and the responsible entity recommend that security holders vote in favour of the resolution. And I now call a poll on item 4A relating to the unstapling and delisting of the foreign company shares. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 4A on your yellow voting card now, or alternatively you can wait till the meeting conclusion. The next three resolutions, items 4B, 4C and 4D in the notice, seek approval to amend the constitutions of the Australian Company and Trust, as well as amend the bylaws of the foreign company. As mentioned previously, these are technical amendments, largely removing references in the constitutions and bylaws, indicating that the foreign company is part of the Infogen stapled security. Item 4B seeks approval to amend the constitution of Infogen Energy Limited, the Australian company. The proposed resolution for item 4B is shown on the screen. The resolutions to be considered by the security holders of the company. The proxies are now displayed on the screen. Security holders wish to ask any questions or make any comments about the proposed amendments to the company's constitution? If not, the directors of the company recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. As there are no further comments or questions, I'll now call a poll on item 4B relating to the amendments of the company's constitutions. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 4B on your yellow voting card now, or otherwise wait till the conclusion of the meeting. Item 4C seeks approval to amend the constitution of Infogen Energy Trust, the Australian Trust. The proposed resolution for item 4C is shown on the screen. This resolution is to be considered by the unit holders of the trust. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the proposed amendments to the trust constitution? The directors of the responsible entity of the trust recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. As there are no comments or questions, I will now call a poll on item 4C relating to the amendments to the trust constitution. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 4C on your yellow voting card now, or otherwise at the end of the meeting. Item 4D seeks approval to amend the bylaws of Infogen Energy, Bermuda Limited, the foreign company. The proposed resolution for item 4D is shown on the screen. And this resolution is to be considered by the security holders of the foreign company. The proxies received for the resolution are now displayed on the screen. Are there any questions or comments about the proposed amendments to the foreign company's bylaws? If not, then the directors of the foreign company recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. And I'll now call a poll on item 4D relating to the amendments to the foreign company's bylaws. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 4D on your yellow voting card now, or otherwise wait until later in the meeting. Item 4E seeks approval for the final stage of the stapling restructure proposal. This is the capital restructure of the Bermudan company itself. This resolution involves, firstly, approval by the foreign company to issue a separate class of shares, convertible redeemable preference shares, as described in the notice of meeting, and secondly, to cancel the ordinary shares issued by the foreign company for nil consideration. As outlined in the notice of meeting, the foreign company has not been used and it holds no assets of substance, hence why the capital reduction is being undertaken at nil value. There's no decrease in assets or value to the continuing listed Infogen Energy Group. If all the resolutions in item 4 are passed, the foreign company will be a dormant subsidiary within the group and it will be wound up. The proposed resolution for item 4E is shown on the screen. And I'm pleased that I'm not reading it out. This resolution is to be considered by the security holders of the foreign company. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Are there any questions or comments regarding the proposed capital reduction of the foreign company? As mentioned, the directors of the foreign company recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. As there are no further questions or comments, I'll now call a poll on item 4E relating to the capital reduction of the foreign company. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 4E on your yellow voting card now, or otherwise wait until later in the meeting. That was the last resolution relating to the stapling restructure proposal. We will now move to item 5 in the notice of meeting. Thank you, security holders, for your attention during all of those resolutions for item 4. The resolution for item 5 seeks a specific approval for the Managing Director, Ross Rolfe, to participate in the Infigen Energy Equity Plan. This approval is required by the ASX listing rules and the Corporations Act because Ross is a director. This resolution is to be considered by the security holders of each of the company, foreign company and the trust. The level of participation offered to Ross under the equity plan has been determined with reference to market practice and within the framework of Infigen's remuneration policy. The performance rights to be awarded to Ross under the plan are at risk, with vesting condition on the performance conditions being satisfied. The performance conditions required sustained and material improvements in relative security holder returns, as well as performance against a scorecard of strategic objectives. Following distribution of the notice of meeting to security holders, additional explanatory information was released to the market in October, covering the performance assessment criteria for each of the strategic objectives, and other details of the equity plan, the proposed level of participation in the plan by Ross, and the performance conditions required to be satisfied were included in the notice of meeting. The proposed resolution for item 5 is as stated in the notice of meeting and shown on the screen. The resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour of the resolution to be passed. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the Managing Director's participation in the equity plan? One at the front.
Antoinette Grant again. I'll keep it very brief. I've already indicated that I'm totally against the whole spectrum of that kind of system. I'd appreciate if people just earned a salary and did their job as would be required under their job descriptions. I just want to say it's not a personal thing, but it's when people look at remuneration, etc., you always look at the Anglo-Saxon world, especially America or UK. You don't look at, for example, Japan, where somebody might, on the top salaries, might only get $600,000. And the other thing is a lot of the big companies now realize that people are very dissatisfied with these kind of systems. And, for example, at the Telstra meeting, people are going the opposite way. And whilst they're not changing sufficiently for my taste, they're at least changing in the right direction of not doing, of more emphasis on long-term plans rather than short-term plans. Thank you.
We will note your comments. Are there any further questions? The voting exclusions on this item apply to Ross and any closely related parties. The resolution is on the screen. And I'll now call a poll on item 5 relating to the Managing Director's participation in the equity plan. Again, security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 5 on your yellow voting card now or otherwise wait until later in the meeting. The resolution for item 6 seeks specific approval of the Executive Director of Finance and Commercial, Sylvia Wiggins, to participate in the Infigen Energy Equity Plan. As I mentioned for the previous item, this approval is required by the ASX listing rules and the Corporations Act because Sylvia is a director. This resolution is to be considered by the security holders of each of the company, foreign company and the trust. The level of participation offered to Sylvia under the equity plan has been determined with reference to market practice and within the framework of Infigen's remuneration policy. Similarly, the performance rights to be awarded to Ross under the plan are at risk, with vesting contingent on performance conditions being satisfied. The performance conditions require sustained and material improvements in relative security holder returns, as well as performance against a scorecard of strategic objectives. Details of the equity plan, the proposed level of participation in the plan by Sylvia, and the performance conditions required to be satisfied were included in the notice of meeting. The proposed resolution for item 6 is as stated in the notice of meeting and shown on the screen. This resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour of the resolution to be passed. And the proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Any security holders wish to make questions or make a comment about Sylvia's participation in the equity plan? The voting exclusions on this item apply to Sylvia and any closely related parties. The other directors of the boards of the company, the foreign company and the responsible entity recommend that security holders vote in favour of Sylvia's participation in the equity plan as set out in the notice of meeting. And I now call a poll on item 6 relating to participation in the equity plan by Sylvia Wiggins. So security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 6 on your yellow voting card now or otherwise wait until later in the meeting. And we will now move to the last item in the notice of meeting. The final item of today's business proposes the reappointment of PricewaterhouseCoopers as auditors of the foreign company at a fee to be determined by the directors. As indicated in the notice of meeting, this ordinary resolution is only required to be voted on by the foreign company. In accordance with company law in Bermuda, the external auditor is to be reappointed each year by shareholders. PricewaterhouseCoopers is the current auditor of the foreign company and the other two stapled entities. PricewaterhouseCoopers has consented to their reappointment as auditor of the foreign company. The proposed resolution is as shown on the screen. The proxies received for the resolution are now displayed on the screen. The directors of the foreign company recommend shareholders vote in favour of the resolution. Do any shareholders wish to make a question or a comment about the proposed reappointment of PricewaterhouseCoopers as auditors of the foreign company? If not, I will now call a poll on item 7 relating to the reappointment of the auditor of the foreign company. We have now arrived at that later time in the meeting to conduct the poll voting and complete the yellow voting cards for all resolutions. I appoint the registry Link Market Services Limited as scrutineers for the poll. All security holders eligible to vote should have received yellow voting cards when you entered the meeting. If there is anyone who is entitled to vote in the poll and who does not have a yellow voting card, would you please raise your hand now and our scrutineers will attend to you immediately. Otherwise, for item numbers 2, 3, 4A, 4B, 4C, 4D, 4E, 5, 6 and 7 on the reverse of your yellow voting cards, could you please mark one of the four against or abstain boxes for each resolution. If you require a pen, these are available from the scrutineers. The scrutineers will connect your voting cards when you are finished. Okay, have all yellow voting cards been collected? That's a yes, then I now declare the poll closed. Thanks very much for your patience, ladies and gentlemen. We will not have a detailed result of the poll voting until all the votes are counted and verified by the scrutineer. This may take a little time. The results are unlikely to be known prior to the conclusion of the meeting today, so the results will be released to the market and placed on Infogen's website as early as possible today. Are there any final questions or comments? Bearing in mind, we're happy to take them as informal comments over a cup of tea shortly.
Some of the big four auditors, there have been recently some questions raised about their performance. I'm not casting any aspersions on anybody. How closely has IFN examined some of the issues that have been raised about the big four and their dominance in the market?
How closely have we examined the issues?
And reappoint, seeking to reappoint them.
I think in bearing in mind of, we've, in reviewing the order and considering their appointment and reappointment, we look at the quality of the work that's been done, the character and issues associated with the company, and their familiarity with our business. So whilst there might be issues inside those particular organisations, I can't say I'm aware of any impact on the people with whom we've been dealing with or their successes. Ross or Sylvia, do you want to elaborate on that?
I'll just make one comment. In Australia, we use PwC Australia, and Australia has a rule that says that each 5 years you actually have to change the name partner in relation to that to ensure ongoing independence in relation to that person not forming too close a ties. That we've been through that process in the last couple of months and replaced a long-standing auditor, Mark Upcoff, who served his 5 years, with Craig Thomason, who now sits in the front. To do that, we went through a very rigorous internal review process where PwC put forward a range of individual partners with different ranges of experience and capabilities and their own individual audit clients. So we've actually been through absolutely in the last couple of months a process that went through me working with my general manager of finance, Nick Learmonth, and then went up to Ross, and then they went through the ARC. So we take this very seriously in terms of ensuring that we've got the best possible firm and the best possible person with independent audit experience to look after Infogen. So we absolutely respect your comments, and we've been through that process in the last couple of months.
Thank you.
I'm sure Craig will be happy to discuss any aspersions possibly cast.
No,
fair question. Are there any other questions or comments? We can discuss nasturtiums and aspersions over a cup of tea. Ladies and gentlemen, as there are no other further questions or comments from security, that ends the business of today's annual general meeting. And accordingly, I now declare the meeting closed. Thank you so much for your attendance and interest in our company. And I invite you now to join us for a light refreshment and an opportunity to discuss further matters relating to our company. Thanks so much for attending.